This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
Our streets are not your playgrounds. Our kids cannot be your collateral damage. We'll not allow you to poison our city.
That's Mayor Tom Menino addressing the killers of four people, including a two-year-old boy, in Mattapan this week. It was the worst single incident of violence in Boston in 5 years, and police think the shooting was a drug deal gone awry. We'll talk about that with our Week in Review panel. But first, there's developing news in the Massachusetts governor's race.
A vote for Tim Cahill is a vote for Deval Patrick.
That stark pronouncement today on WCVB was from Cahill's own running mate. Paul Lascoco is quitting Cahill's independent ticket and endorsing Republican candidate Charlie Baker. This in the same week that two of Cahill's top campaign staffers jump ship.
I think that our message has not resonated with the voters.
But State Democratic Party Chair John Walsh shot back with this statement. Charlie Baker's Republican backroom deal reeks of the kind of raw political scheming that voters are angry about. Voters should also be asking what Mr. Lascoco is getting in return from the Baker campaign. Cahill, meanwhile, says he's still in the game. Just about an hour ago, he spoke to reporters and echoed the Democrats' claim of a backroom deal.
If this hasn't proven beyond a shadow of a doubt who the true outsider in this race is, it should. Because the schemes to put certain things in place and make things possible for both sides of the aisle have not been done in a straight-handed fashion, and we've been running in a straight-handed fashion all the way through.
We're going to be talking about this very shortly because we have on our panel this week independent journalist Ken Cooper. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you, Sasha.
And also WBUR reporter Anthony Brooks. Good to have you here, Anthony.
Good to see you, Sasha.
And listeners, we're taking calls during this Political Review and Week segment. So give us a call to talk about your Boston area stories. Let us know what you think about whether Tim Cahill can still stay in this race now that he's had so many defections. We'll also be talking about the new texting and driving ban and a lot of other news going on this week, including those Mattapan shootings, which have really shaken up a lot of Boston. So you can weigh in at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So on the governor's race, Ken Cooper, does this mean that Cahill's campaign is truly once and for all over?
Pretty much so. If it's not over, it's pretty close to it. The withdrawal of his running mate, taking with him presumably other Republican support, the lack of a running mate to campaign with him and for him and on his behalf also undermines his campaign. It looks a little bit like his campaign is imploding.
And so I believe that Lascoco will still be on the ticket because it's too late to come off, but his campaigning for Cahill is done. It's all over. This is after losing his campaign manager, after losing one of his top aides who used to work for John McCain. Anthony Brooks, you spent some time with Cahill this week, and he told you he's staying in the race till the very end.
He did, and he said that again today. And in a funny way, I agree with Kurt, but in a funny way, this sort of gives Cahill maybe some fumes to kind of continue on a little bit. I mean, he's the defiant one, and in a way, this allows him to sort of make that case. And he made it to me earlier this week, and we've got some tape to play. He made the point again and again that no one has yet voted, and he's insisting on staying in the race until someone does vote. And he rejects this idea that he should be involved in this calculation that a vote for him takes votes away from Charlie Baker and helps Deval Patrick. Let's listen.
For me, anyway, it's never been about reelecting Patrick or hurting Baker. It's about giving people a third choice because they are sick and tired of the party system. And they're still very close, if not below, the threshold of actually being able to win this race, which tells me that people still haven't made up their minds. And that's why I don't want to give up, because I don't think people want me to give up.
And so are you saying you're in it until November 2nd, no matter what?
Yeah, that's what I've been saying from day one. Nobody's cast a ballot yet. For me to walk away because some polls say that I can't win, I think would be defeating the purpose.
Now, Anthony Brooks, it's important to note that conversation you had with Cahill happened before this morning when Cahill's running mate bailed out on him. But even just within the past hour, he says he's plowing onward.
Yep.
Now, you've actually said he has said he thinks he may have an advantage without a running mate. Tell us how that could be possible.
You got to love what Tim Cahill said today. He said, as to Paul, well, it looks like I have one fewer vote today. As for not having a lieutenant governor, I don't plan to die and we can save money on that useless office.
Ken Cooper, what is Cahill's motivation at this point to stay in this race?
Well, I think it's very much the reason that any politician runs for office. It's his own sense of ambition and his belief in himself, perhaps personal stubbornness. But I think it would be the exception would be for a candidate to withdraw under these circumstances. That's usually not what happens. They'll go through to the bitter end, no matter how few miles per gallon they get from the fumes left in their campaign.
It's true. And, Sasha, keep in mind that he's got, you know, he's got $750,000 of state money. He's got other money in the till. He can stay on the air and tell the campaign. He can continue to sort of harbor this belief. Don't forget, back in the spring, he was a viable alternative to Governor Patrick, and then the Republican Governors Association clobbered him with these commercials, and his numbers just went down. But I think in some core of his soul, he believes he can get back there, and that's why he's sticking it out.
And as you say, if he has the money, why not spend
it?
Why
not? Yeah.
Ken Cooper, Anthony Brooks just referenced this. The defections are because the people defecting say that a vote for Cahill is a vote for Charlie Baker. And conventional wisdom has been that Cahill siphons votes away from Charlie Baker. However, a recent Boston Globe poll showed that Cahill is drawing votes away equally from Baker and Patrick. So, Ken Cooper, does that poll weaken the Democrats' claim that LaScocco, Tim Cahill's running mate, defecting over to Charlie Baker is just a Republican ploy?
Well, it could undermine it, but the fact is that LaScocco was a Republican, and he endorsed a Republican candidate. It certainly looks like, particularly the time, and since his name can't be removed from the ballot, it certainly looks like he's doing what his former fellow Potter-sons wished him to do. And I don't know about any backroom exchanges, but given my experience covering politics, I would not be surprised if that's what is planned and intended.
Let me have you briefly comment on another candidate who gets much less attention than the other three, and this is Jill Stein, the Green Rainbow candidate. She was trying to qualify for public campaign finances. She missed qualification by $3,000, which is really tiny money. And maybe this doesn't even register on the radar given the other news, but either one of you want to jump in and say, how much do we pay attention to this news?
Helps Patrick marginally. Probably depresses turnout marginally. People who are not going to vote otherwise without her on the ballot.
I agree with that. I mean, of course, Jill Stein has no chance of winning, but I think she brings something to the debate. I think when she's at the debates, issues are raised that need to be raised. So, you know, in a sense, I think this takes something away from the quality of the debate that we're seeing, but that's the way this political system is structured.
Listeners, we're in the middle of our Week in Review panel. We have independent journalist Ken Cooper and also WBUR reporter Anthony Brooks. We're taking calls during this segment. We've been talking politics, the governor's race. We're also going to be talking about the Mattapan shooting that happened this week. We'll be talking about the new texting ban that went into effect yesterday. We'll also be talking about the Boston Globe's announcement yesterday that Boston.com is going to remain free, but a new website is going to charge if you want to try to read the paper online. So call us about any or all of that. We want to know what you think of the texting ban, the Globe going behind a paywall, and the Mattapan shooting. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Again, that's 1-800-423-TALK. So let's turn to the Mattapan shooting. This is truly, truly tragic news from earlier this week. Five people shot, four dead. This is in Mattapan early Tuesday morning. Police say it looks like a drug deal gone bad. One victim was a two-year-old boy. Ken Cooper, Boston has gotten sadly used to hearing about these kinds of shootings, including shootings involving children. But is this one different?
Well, there are some details here that are particularly outrageous. What really is the point of killing a two-year-old who can't be a witness against you no matter what? What is the point of leaving naked bodies exposed outdoors? If not, it sounds like an act of terrorism. Maybe the perpetrators were watching television and saw where Colombian and Mexican drug gangs do things like that. But it is in fact quite an outrage. The police investigation seems to be going apace and pretty soundly. I'm more concerned. I mean, they'll do what they have to do. I'm concerned about what happens in that particular neighborhood where everybody seems, a good many residents seem to be cowering in fear inside their homes. They don't know each other. There are some community organizers there from Mattapan already working, and they had been working to sort of build up a sense of community spirit. People need to know their neighbors, and they need to be strong enough to submit and transmit messages that this is a peaceful, law-abiding community, and you break that code, and then you're going to get you out of here.
Ken Cooper, you referenced naked bodies, and that's, of course, a reference to the fact that at least two of these victims were found in the middle of the street, in the middle of the morning, no clothes on. It's unclear whether they were dragged out of bed. Fred Tice, one of our reporters, was there this week. He said the crime scene was several blocks, not a block, but blocks. And Joan Vinaki at the Globe had a line in which she talked about the sheer savagery of it looking foreign, like something out of Mexico or Colombia, which is what you just referenced, Ken. Anthony Brooks, you talked to a lot of people in Mattapan this week because you also reported on this, and you had talked to the Reverend Gene Rivers. He called the shooting a game changer. What does he mean by that?
Well, I think what the Reverend Rivers was talking about was pretty much what Ken was referring to, and that is this raised the bar. It was like there was a new level of savagery that was so apparent here. And what Gene was also talking about, the point that he was making to me was that the city is responding to the violence in these neighborhoods as if it was 15 years ago. And we had a pretty good strategy in place 15 years ago to deal with this. Boston did. And it's the Reverend Rivers' contention that we need to, the city leaders with neighborhood organizers and the clergy need to sit down again and sort of refashion a new response to this new kind of violence.
Anthony Brooks, that strategy 15 years ago was what, if you could briefly describe
well,
it?
Well, in a sense, it's a strategy that is still going on today. It's a number of things. It's a close cooperation between law enforcement and community leaders. It's made up of various elements. One of them is called Operation Ceasefire, in which law enforcement works with parole and really targets the heart of these gangs and goes after them and really gets them either in prison or to police themselves. And Boston for a long while was considered a model, and they did this very well. We drifted away from Operation Ceasefire for a while, but my understanding is that Commissioner Davis is again embracing it. And actually, notwithstanding the horror of what happened this week, Boston has been doing pretty well. Violent crime has been trending down. But as another sort of source in the story said to me, who's watched this, we can't inoculate ourselves against this kind of violence. It's always going to be there. So I don't want to make light of what happened, but I think the overall trend, the feeling is we've been moving in the right direction.
Police today are saying that they believe they've recovered the SUV the shooters drove and also two handguns used in the killing. Here's Mayor Menino again.
Cowards kill. Cowards use guns to settle their scores. Cowards hide. Let me tell you, Mattapan is strong, and we will not let them hide.
Anthony Brooks, Menino had a line in which he said, cowards use guns to settle their scores. You and I were chatting a bit this morning, and you honed in on that reference to guns. You want to talk about why you brought that up?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why this kind of violence still occurs. I mean, you've got to talk about poverty, you've got to talk about joblessness, you've got to talk about anger, you've got to talk about the disaffection in these neighborhoods, and these are all serious problems that have to be looked at, and they are getting attention, they probably need more attention. There's also the problem of guns. Guns are very readily available. And I know this is a pet issue of Mayor Menino's. And one of the things he's focused on is, although Massachusetts has relatively strong gun control legislation, it's very easy for folks to go out of state to New Hampshire, for example, to a gun show and pick up a gun.
You were describing to me this morning roadside flea markets almost, where you could buy cannons. And
well, I went to a gun show recently just driving through southern New Hampshire, and it was a bit of a carnival atmosphere. And I don't want to necessarily be disrespectful to people who are there. Some of the people are hunters, they're sportsmen, they're licensed, they're responsible. However, in that mix, there is the ability to go in there, buy guns without a background check, load up your trunk, and bring them back into the city. And people like Mayor Menino and other mayors, including Mayor Bloomberg of New York and others around the country, are very, very concerned about this so-called gun show loophole. And the folks who are concerned about that, their arguments got a little more persuasive, I guess you could say, this week in Boston.
Ken Cooper, I want to read something that I want you to comment on. This was a comment posted on WBUR.org this week by someone named Els Curtis. And this is what the person said. The families of these areas, where parents are often forced to work two or three underpaid jobs, suffering long hours on inadequate public transportation, require an effort of total repair. Jobs that restore the commitment to building social capital through adequate paid time off, infrastructure that allows commuters to be present at home for meals and homework time, housing stock that assumes accessibility. Why are these considered privilege? Ken Cooper, the commenter talks about a need for an effort of total repair. Do you have a vision of what that effort of total repair might look like?
Well, I could outline a vision, but I don't think it's going to happen like that. We've talked a little about what happens in the neighborhood and what needs to happen with respect to community organizing and developing community sentiment of intolerance of illegal activity. From without of the community, which goes to this person's point, I think the captains of business in Boston and in around Boston need to send messages of opportunity to those communities, to the young people in particular. I'm talking about engagement with schools. I'm talking about summer jobs. I'm talking about part-time jobs during the year so that these young men in particular, young black men, grow up with a notion that if they do the right things, if they go to school, if they stay out of trouble with the law, they can actually make a decent living and lead respectful lives.
So that they have hope and opportunity.
So they have hope and opportunity.
But you don't feel very positive about that happening.
Well, in terms of things like housing and mass transit, and I would start with the community organizing, move to the jobs, and then if you can do those other things, and that would be helpful too.
Let's talk about the ban on texting that went into effect in Massachusetts yesterday, because this is a piece of news that pretty much affects everyone. Even if you don't text while you drive, you probably drive or you're in cars, and if you're on the road, it matters. I want to quote from the law itself. It says, vehicle operators cannot use any mobile electronic device to write, send, or read an electronic message, including text messages, emails, instant messages, or accessing the internet while operating a vehicle. This law applies even if the vehicle is stopped in traffic. So we sent our Radio Boston intern, Griff McNerney, out this week to see what Bostonians think about all of this. And here's what one person said.
My name's Christy. I think it's a great idea, although it probably doesn't go far enough. You should ban handheld uses altogether, I think.
Charles Lodi. I'm from Boston. I don't know. I don't think it'll work. It doesn't work in California. It won't work here. People are going to crash their cars no matter what.
My name's Anthony Bundak. I'm from Los Angeles, where texting's already banned, but everyone does it anyway, so I don't think people should text while they drive, unless they're very confident in their driving. I think everyone should not do it but me, basically.
Carol Crawford. I live in West Roxbury. Forget about the texting. The phone should be illegal, period. End of it. From what I read, I guess it's not going to be too successful, but we can hope. Paper saying they're going to just take more time, the kids, I mean, are going to take more time with their eyes off the road by keeping it below the dashboard so they can't be seen.
Ken Cooper and Anthony Brooks, let me have you tell me each briefly what you think about this ban. And Anthony Brooks, why don't we start with you?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, I guess the first thing's hard to enforce. On the other hand, I guess what we're now the 31st state with a texting ban, so it seemed to make sense. And this is what strikes me. This is common sense, folks. I mean, anyone who's tried to text, and yes, I've done it, and you shouldn't do it, and keep your eye on a car on the road where things come at you, you know, in seconds. It's crazy. And it reminds me, my guess is that in 5 or 10 years, this is going to be one of those things where we're going to look back and say, can you believe that there used to be, this used to be legal? It sort of reminds me of when I was growing up, I was in a car without seat belts and a metal dashboard, and three kids were kind of bouncing around inside, and my mother was smoking with all the windows up, and that was normal. And yet, you know, we've learned that, you know, no, you got to put the kids in the back seat, you got to buckle them in and open the windows and not smoke and all that sort of stuff. So I think this is going to be one of those things where, yeah, it's pretty obvious, and people shouldn't text when
they're driving. Texting while driving becomes the new normal.
I would think so.
Ken Cooper?
I make the same comparison as Anthony, that I think that this will eventually become as accepted as seatbelt usage is, and very much the same reasons. Whenever I'm driving or walking and I see somebody texting or with their hands stuck to their face while they're talking on the phone, I get very nervous because I know they're not paying adequate attention to driving and I'm sharing the road with them in some fashion.
I had to do a story on this a few months ago, and it was amazing to me the rationalizations people had for why they can safely text and drive. Someone said they thought actually texting while on a highway was actually the most safe of all because you're in a straight line, you can see what's coming at you. So I would think about it differently, but this person didn't. We have a caller on this. This is Paul from Nashua, New Hampshire. Paul, do you approve of the Massachusetts texting ban?
Hi, Sasha. No, I do approve of the ban. I think that it's long overdue, and like the reporters on the show today, I think it is going, you know, it is common sense, and we'll look back on it, and we'll be surprised that we do it, but the pushback that I hear all the time, I teach high school students, and they're very confident that they can do both things well, and a lot of people misunderstand the difference between multitasking and dividing your attention, and they assume that they're multitasking, which they're not doing. They are dividing their attention, and you can't attend to two things at once adequately. And that's the part that seems to be missed. So the people who say that, you know, like the person you interviewed who said they could do it on the highway, you know, it's even more dangerous because they're emboldened to try and do it longer, and that's very unfortunate.
Paul, thank you for that. And that raises the issue that some studies have found that texting bans don't work, and some research says these bans can actually increase texting-related accidents, perhaps because now people are trying to do it covertly or furtively, and so their eyes are looking down on their lap instead of on the windshield. But that latter study that said bans can increase texting was backed by a group of insurers who oppose texting bans. So I wonder, Ken and Anthony, do you think it's possible that texting bans are actually useless and counterproductive?
Well, you know, there's studies and there's studies. I just cannot see how, in the end, if a ban is in fact observed, that it does anything but to the good. Respect to the college, teenagers are confident that they can do a lot of things.
I mean, they make the same arguments about, you know, I remember driver's ed as a teenager, right? You're told everyone believes that they can drink and then drive. And you sort of, you know, the laws are there for two reasons. One, to stop people from doing it, but also to educate them not to do it. And whether or not the ban can stop them, I think it can begin to put that message out to educate.
Let me move on to the Globe's announcement yesterday, a significant move. This is the announcement that Boston.com will remain a free site, but it will have largely classified ads, entertainment listings, calendar listings, some breaking news. That'll be free. If you want to read the paper online, which you now can do on Boston.com if you go to this little section called Today's Boston Globe, if you want to read the paper online, you're going to have to pay for it. There's going to be a subscription-only website called BostonGlobe.com. That will include the contents of the actual hard copy newspaper, and that will require a paid subscription. Ken Cooper, is this a good move for the Globe?
Absolutely. It's actually about time. I've been a longtime believer in that newspapers can't continue to give it away for free. Now, there are those who will say right away, well, people are used to having it for free and they're not going to pay. And my response is always the same. I'm old enough to remember when television used to be free. Now almost everybody pays for cable.
Uncomplainingly. I mean, they may complain about the bill, but they still consider it a fact of life.
Right. So it's absolutely the right thing to do, whether this particular model makes sense for the Globe because it has this portal that is very popular. But it may undergo some fine-tuning and change over time, but it's the way to go.
Now, Anthony Brooks, I think the Globe has known for a long time it had to do this, but it was hoping other papers would do it too, so they're sort of a critical mass. They're kind of the only pioneer, but not many are doing it. What do you think? Is this just going to cause readers to go to papers where they can read it for free?
Well, I agree wholeheartedly with what Ken said. I think if the Globe is taking a chance, it's because of what you just said. There's an awful lot of information for free out there. So my only concern on behalf of the Globe would be how many of those people are going to say, well, no thanks, because I can go to, you know, 1,000 other sites that are free. So until we reach that critical mass that you referenced, it's not clear how, if, or when this model will be successful.
Let's now, in the time we have left, do what we call our weekly hubbub. We define hubbub as something that caught your eye, or something that you think was a little under the radar, or something that was a little quirky for the week. Anything at all. Ken Cooper, let's start with you. What's your hubbub this week?
My hubbub has to do with the core reform law that the governor signed in August. The first provision of it goes into effect November 4th, and it bans employers from asking about criminal convictions on initial job applications. The curious thing about the Massachusetts law is it may not go far enough to actually help ex-offenders get in the door and get interviews so they have a better chance of explaining the circumstances and getting a job. The first state to do this, Hawaii, not only banned the question on the initial application, but they also banned employers from checking criminal records until a conditional offer of employment had been made. As the way things stand now in Massachusetts, an employer can forego the question on applications, winnow the pool down to, say, a small number of finalists, check criminal records, further winnow the pool before conducting interviews.
Anthony Brooks, let's hear your hubbub of the week.
Well, you know, Ken, you sort of put me to shame. This is an important story that you just referenced. And my hubbub this week is, as we know, the Red Sox were mathematically eliminated. This means they're not going to the World Series. They're not going to win the World Series. But the thing that I'm struck by this week is, and now I'm saying this as a lifelong Red Sox fan, I don't care. And it's a liberation. And the reason I don't care is because we've won it. We won it in 2004, thank God. We did it in 2007. And suddenly I'm finding myself a lifelong Red Sox fan. And I don't care if we get to the end of the baseball season and we lost. And it just feels tremendously liberating. So that's what I was struck by this week.
My husband says this, too. He says, losses don't hurt anymore because I'm happy forever.
That's it. I'm happy forever. Let the Yankees win. Let Tampa Bay win. And, you know, maybe we'll win next year. Maybe not. It doesn't matter.
My hubbub is really just a plug for something, and I have no involvement in this, so I have no conflict of interest. It's free, so it's not a profit maker for anyone. There's this Boston Local Food Festival happening this weekend. I just happen to like food, and I really like free food. This has a lot of free or cheap food, $5 or less. Happens down at Fort Point Channel on the Congress Street Bridge, right near the Children's Museum. And it's just to emphasize locally sourced Massachusetts Boston area food. Cooking and garden demonstrations. They're going to do a fish filleting demo. They're going to have this cooking contest that they call the Seafood Throwdown. It's from 11 to 5 tomorrow. It's going to be a beautiful day after several days of rain. Sounds like something that could be worth going to. Again, I have no interest in this. I just think it sounded really great. Thank you to both of you very much for coming on the show. Ken Cooper is an independent journalist, and Anthony Brooks is a reporter at WBUR. Thanks a lot to both of you for coming to the show.
Thank you, Sasha.
Thank you, Sasha.
We're about to take a break, but when we come back, we will take you to the Ig Nobel Awards in Cambridge, where scientists are recognized for research on the sex lives of bats and how swearing helps relieve pain, among other scientific research. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston. Stay with us.